The grace of the Lord be with you this day. You're listening to a message delivered at Christ Community Church in Myerstown, Pennsylvania. Our mission is to love God, serve people, and inspire hope. For more information about our ministries, go to christcom.church. That's christcom with two M's, .church. Our lead pastor is Dr. Timothy Valentino, founder of This New Life, which is the online home of Tim and Sonia Valentino. For uplifting resources, theological reflections, and even a few laughs, go to timandsonia.net. That's Tim and Sonia with a Y, .net. Thanks for listening, and be sure to stop back again. Now, grab a Bible, and let's get to the Word.
In a series we're calling Carved in Stone, Some of God's Ways for All of God's People. Now, before we get to the first commandment, I want to give us some help in remembering the Ten Commandments. If I were to ask how many of us could recite all Ten Commandments in order, how many of us could do it? Don't raise your hands. But I suspect that a lot of believers today, church attending believers, have trouble getting all of them in order. And so I want to give you a silly little way to remember this. We teach this to our kids, but you know, adults are just, we're older kids, right? And so I want to give you a silly way to remember this. And I'd like to do this with the following phrase. Gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe for children. Isn't that silly? Let's say it together. Gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe for children. Well, you didn't say it like you really meant it, but that's okay. You'll never forget this. What I'd like to do is highlight the first letter of each word of that little silly phrase to help us remember the Ten Commandments. So, the first one is the letter G. And what is the first commandment? Well, let's just put them all up here and you'll see how this works. The first commandment has to do with no other gods. Gum is I. No idols. Gum is very. V. No vain speech. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Gum is very sticky. Keep or remember the Sabbath. Gum is very sticky. Help. H. Honor your parents. Gum is very sticky. Help keep. The K there is for no killing. Gum is very sticky. Help keep America. That's for no adultery. Gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe. That's for no stealing. Gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe for. The F there is for no false witness. And finally, gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe for children. The C there stands for no coveting. Got it? I trust you'll never forget it. What's our phrase again? Gum is very sticky. Help keep America safe for children. You got it. You got it. Now, what does the G stand for? No other gods. What's the I for? No idols. What's the V for? No vain speech. What is the S for? Remember the Sabbath. What's the H for? Honor your parents. How about that K? No killing. How about the A? Adultery. How about the S? No stealing. How about the F? No false witness. How about the C? No coveting. Help keep America safe for children. There it is. You got it. All right. You'll never forget it, silly though it is. I trust you'll never forget it. Well, why don't we get into the Word, huh? Exodus 20, and we'll begin with verse 1 as we did last week, and we'll pick up the first commandment. And God spoke all these words. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. What's our phrase again? Gum is. All right, very good. And what is that first one? No other gods. That's the one we're looking at today. You shall have no other gods before me. My first real paying job happened to be as a snack bar worker at Hillside Swimming Pool on 14th Street in Reading. First paycheck I got. And when I got my first paycheck, I wondered where the rest of it was. You know how you discover taxes for the first time as a child. I think I might have been 15 at the time. Well, that was my job, to serve people snacks, candy and hot food and other things. Well, one day, a 5-year-old girl came to my window and she ordered French fries. She was adorable. I mean, she had shoulder length, sandy brown hair, freckles all over the place, and just the biggest blue eye. I mean, she was absolutely adorable. And she asked for French fries. So with great delight, I went and prepared the French fries. And when they were done, I put them in front of her and I said, "That will be 55 cents. That's what it was back then, 55 cents. And this little girl put a penny on the counter. Well, being the softy that I was, I gave her 54 cents so that she could have her French fries. Paid the balance myself. I was getting a paycheck by that. No big deal for me to pay 54 cents. But to her, that was a lot of money. She obviously didn't have a job. She couldn't possibly afford to pay it on her own. So I paid it for her. And so that beautiful girl left my window with something she didn't earn and something she could not pay for herself. Now, she certainly didn't understand the generosity behind the gift, I'm sure of that. If she had, maybe she would have shared those French fries with her friends. But she didn't. When she walked away from my window, I could see her on her towel on the grass. And you know how it is, when you get food at the pool, you suddenly get a lot of friends to go with it. And her friends were coming up to her and pulling French fries out of the pile. And she was getting mad at them. And she started kind of covering up the French fries and insulating her French fries from all her friends who just showed up. And she was getting madder and madder and more miserable as others kept trying to get at her French fries. And I remember looking at her in frustration and thinking to myself, "It serves you right, little girl, you ingrate. 54 cents worth of those fries are mine." Parents tend to work hard to get their children to share, right? Isn't that part of our job description? Help our children overcome their natural tendency to keep things to themselves, to be selfish, or, you know, we try hard as parents to tame that drive against hoarding, you know, that drive that says, "I got to have more, I got to accumulate, and I'm just going to get more and more." We as parents work hard teaching our children how to share. And that is good and right and proper. That's good parenting. And yet, the fact is, there are some things in life that were never meant to be shared. I wouldn't put French fries in that list. But there are some things that go in that list. There are some things in life that were never meant to be shared. One M&M. That's not meant to be shared. A unicycle. You're getting an image now of trying to share a unicycle. It doesn't work. It wasn't meant to be shared. Answers to a test. No, you have to come up with those on your own, and your classmates can't share them with you if they know them. How about a spouse? Marital intimacy between husband and wife. That wasn't meant to be shared with somebody other than your spouse. Some things are not meant to be shared. And you know, for as kind and generous and loving as God is, there are some things that even he won't share. Isaiah 42, verse 8 says, "God will not share his glory with any other God." And that is really the first commandment at its heart. You shall have no other gods before me. God insists here that he have no rivals. in our hearts and minds. No competition. And this, of course, is where the Ten Commandments begin after that great statement of rescue that we talked about last week. It all begins here. In other words, if we get this one wrong, we get everything wrong. Even if we get everything else right, we get it all wrong because we didn't start here. So I want to look, first of all, at the language of the First Commandment. The language of the First Commandment. I think it's significant that this commandment, and really all the commandments, they come at us in grammatically what is the second person singular. In other words, it's you. Not you all, but you, singular. In other words, these commands are for every single individual. It's not y'all, but you and me. And the point is that these are divine directives for every single member of the covenant community. You can't hide from these commandments. You can't slither under the pew and say, that one's not for me. That's the point of the second person singular, you. Now remember, as we said last week, these commandments have their foundation in grace. God rescues his people before he realigns them, before he regulates them. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. That's where the Ten Commandments begin, with a statement of rescue. And God says, now, having been rescued by my grace, here is how you live out that grace in your life. Here's what it looks like. And here's where it starts. No other gods before me. Or literally, al pene in the Hebrew here means no other gods before or against my face. No other gods. You shall have no other gods before my face or against my face. It could be translated either way. And you see this expression several other places in the Old Testament. For example, Job 4 in verse 15. A spirit glided al pene, past my face or before my face. 2 Kings 23 verse 27. I will remove Judah also from my presence. Literally, from my face. Al pene. Out of my sight is the idea. Isaiah 65 in verse 3. You are a people who continually provoke me, says God, to my face, al pene. Against my face is the idea there. And there are other examples we could give, but those suffice to make the point. Now, the problem here is, does the Hebrew mean before me or against me in the sense of accept me? That's the conundrum here. As a matter of interpretation. If the command says, you will have no other gods before me or before my face, the implication could be that you can have them, I just don't want to see them. Right? And some people take it that way. They're wrong. because really, this is trying to tell us, you will have no other god except me. That's what God is saying to his people. I'm it. I'm not to be shared. I will not share my glory with any other deity that could be named. Dagon, Malkim, Moloch, Baal, Chemosh. I mean, the list is long of the deities worshipped in the ancient world. You shall have no other gods before me or except me. In other words, polytheism, the worship of many gods, is strictly prohibited in ancient Israel. In fact, that is how the Greek Old Testament translates this verse. You shall have no other gods except me. So a couple hundred years before Jesus ever came, the Old Testament Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek. It's called the Septuagint, and that's how they translated this verse. They got it right, I think. That's the sense. No other gods except me. That's what God is saying. In other words, for the Israelites to worship any other god, be it Dagon or Moloch or Malkim or Chemosh, it would be disloyalty to Yahweh. It would be having a spiritual affair against your covenant head. That's the idea here. Besides, as it says in Deuteronomy 32, 39, there is no god beside me. Says God, I mean, when it all comes down to it, there's no God beside me. Same thing in 2 Samuel 7:22. There is no one like you, no God like you, and apart from you, there is no God. Many verses along those lines in the Old Testament, too. Now, this commandment is not saying to the Hebrew people, be unkind to people who worship other gods. He's not saying that. He's just saying, don't do what they do. Don't worship who they worship. That's the point. The adherents of other religions are going to do what they're going to do. But do not participate in their false worship. Rather, be a light to them and show them that Yahweh is the true and living God. Now, this commandment, as we just said, there are no other gods, really. Well, then, what does this command even mean? If the other gods are not real gods, what is the point of this command? What's the point of it, right? Well, here's the point. In a sense, they're real. In a sense, they are real. What we have here is a Hebrew idiom. When you keep bumping into that phrase, no, there is no other God but me, that's actually an expression. And it has a certain nuanced meaning. And I'll give you a couple examples. At one point in Israel's history, Babylon thumps its chest in great arrogance and says, there is no city besides ours. Well, that's a dumb thing to say. There's plenty of other cities, right? There's a city, and there's a city, and there's a city. But Babylon is saying there's no city besides our city, by which they mean there's no city greater than ours. We're tops. We're the best. We lead the list. We're number one. Think of the foam finger, right? We are number one. No city besides us. Same thing, Nineveh in Zephaniah's day. Same thing. They had the same arrogant boast. There's no city besides ours. Well, of course, they knew there were many cities around them. What they're saying is, we're better than all the cities around us. This is a Hebrew idiom. It's not saying that those other gods aren't real. They just are so subpar by comparison. And this word for gods, Elohim in Hebrew, has a wide range of meanings. And I think it's very, very significant and important to point out that Elohim carries it's a classification of being. Elohim, it can refer to angels, it can refer to seraphim, it can refer to cherubim, it can refer to demons sometimes. It's a word that's used of the conjured up Saul. Remember when they conjured up King Saul? It's called an Elohim. Elohim is a supernatural being in the invisible world. It's not a physical being, it's a supernatural being, Elohim. And these other false gods, meaning they're there, they're real, at least in the perception of those who worship them. And they have a real power and a real influence over those who do. And because that's true, God says, I want no rival to my authority. None. Because you can get sucked up into this. So here we have this first commandment as phrased. It prohibits any non-earthly being from rivaling God's authority, be they cherubim or seraphim or angels, principalities, power, spirits, demons, conjured up souls from the dead. It doesn't matter. Worship God alone. That's the idea. Yahweh is the one true and living God. No rival. Now, okay, that's just a little bit of the wording of this commandment, but I want you to put yourself in the sandals of some ancient Hebrew at the foot of Mount Sinai getting this commandment. Let's look at the context of this first commandment. Where have you been for the last 400 years? Not you personally, but you and all your people, your ancestors. You have been in Egypt. Egypt, for most of its history in the ancient world, was a polytheistic country. Poly meaning many. Theist meaning God. There are many gods. Egypt had thousands and thousands of gods. So did Mesopotamia. So did most of the ancient world at that time. Many, many gods to be worshipped. That's a nightmare keeping them all straight. But it's just how the ancient world worked. You had a God, a deity, an Elohim for everything, for every life function, for eating, for drinking, for having pleasure, for experiencing intimacy. You had a God for all of that. You had a deity for every human desire. You had a deity for everything in nature. There's the sun god, the moon god, the stars are gods. They're all named. And they're all to be worshipped in the way prescribed by the priests of those cultures. Thousands of deities. Now, I should probably say that at one brief point in Egypt's history, they kind of lunged toward monotheism. They worshipped one god. They said there's got to be one above all, because in polytheism, none is supreme. They're all duking it out. They're all trying to be supreme, but none really are. One point in Israel's history, they lunged toward monotheism by worshiping Akhenaten. And it's really interesting as you go back and read the prayers and the hymns of ancient Egypt, many of them have survived, they actually grapple with this subject. Where did these gods come from? That's an interesting question, isn't it? If you got many of them, like, okay, where did they all come from? Why are they here? And the priests begin wrestling with this subject in the literature. And one of them said, I'll never forget this. One priest said, well, he sired himself. Referring to one of these deities, he sired himself. He fathered himself. In other words, he created himself. And they're wrestling with this idea. They know it's illogical to have all these multiple deities, but they go with it because that's the culture. Everybody's doing it. Sound familiar? When Israel was in Egypt for 400 years, they began to be affected by the culture. Let me read for you Ezekiel 20, verse 7 and 8. And I said to them, each of you, get rid of the vile images you've set before your eyes, and do not defile yourselves with the gods of Egypt. I'm the Lord your God. But they rebelled against me, God said, wouldn't listen to me. They didn't get rid of these images that they set their eyes on, nor did they forsake the gods of Egypt. See what's happening here? God's people in Egypt, 4+ centuries, how could they not help but be affected by the culture around them? But God rescues them, brings them to Sinai, and commandment number one, after the declaration of rescue, no other gods. That is a shock to this people, because all they've known up to this point is many gods. This is as countercultural a statement as you could possibly say to the Hebrews who were rescued out of Egypt. But they kept giving in. They just kind of assimilated in with the culture. When in Rome, do as Rome. When in Egypt, do as Egypt, right? As we said last week, it's one thing to get Israel out of Egypt. It's another thing to get Egypt out of Israel. And God begins to get Egypt out of Israel with this first commandment. No other gods. No other gods before my face. No other gods against my face. I don't want to see them. They're not really real. And they're subpar. So this first commandment is, I think it's radical. It's sobering. It's exclusivistic. It's a religious overhaul. Monotheism now codified in God's law. Well, we see that this commandment, the very first one, was broken time and time again by the people who received them. Now let's look at the violation of the first commandment. The violation of the first commandment. I mean, there's so many examples of this. I could give hundreds. And, you know, I could give examples from my own life. It's not just pick on the ancient Israelites. We'll get to application in a moment. But let's just take Solomon as an example. King Solomon. Do you remember King Solomon? God said, you can have anything you want. God said, and Solomon says, good, give me wisdom. Give me wisdom. And you would think, okay, well, the rest of his life's going to be wonderful, right? It really wasn't. Here is David's son, who God gave him wisdom. He governed really well for a time. You remember that incident when the two ladies are fighting over the baby? Whose baby is it? This one or this one? And Solomon very wisely says, well, cut the kid in half. And each can get a half. And the real mother shouts, no, don't kill my baby. And Solomon says, that's the real mother. Give the whole child to her. And the fraud was exposed. I mean, people came from all over the globe, it says, to hear of Solomon's legendary wisdom. He was a generous man. We know that because of all that he collected to give toward the building of the temple. He was a man of prayer. His prayer over the temple and the dedication ceremony was one of the most touching you could read in all of Scripture. Many wonderful things about Solomon, and yet, 1 Kings 11, 4 through 6, listen to these words. As Solomon grew old, his wives, I smell a problem already. His wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord as the heart of David, his father, had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. And so Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, keyword completely, as David his father had done. He violated the first commandment. Started worshiping and serving other gods who were no gods at all. Or certainly not the top god. Solomon wound up following the gods he once rejected. And the question is, how did that happen? How did that happen? Because if it can happen to the wisest person in the world, it can happen to us, can't it? If we're not diligent, that word completely, following the Lord completely. We know that he drifted. What were the influences of his drifting? He had external influences, his wives, who had other gods, and they brought those other gods to Israel where Solomon was. And, you know, if you're a people pleaser, don't raise your hand, but any people pleasers here? You go along to get along? Okay, well, you worship that god, you just go right ahead, I'll do that too, just to make peace. God says that's a violation of commandment number one. Solomon did that. Go along to get along. But more than that, his internal desires. There was something in Solomon that really, well, it's greed. Which, by the way, the New Testament calls greed idolatry. We'll say more about that next week. Greed is an idol. Or idols of the heart, said Ezekiel. But you realize, the scripture tells us that Solomon spent 7 years building God's temple. 7 years to build the house of the Lord. What a commitment. Yeah, but he spent 13 years building his own palace. Did you realize that? You go back and you read the story, you see it tucked away there in 1 Kings and beyond. It's just a fascinating story of how this guy drifted. 7 years building the house of God. 13 years to build my house, my palace. See a problem here? It's a sobering reminder that the time and the effort we spend on ourselves versus the time and the effort we spend on the things of God, it could trip us up if we're out of balance, if we don't get the first thing first. Are you with me? I know this is a sobering, this is a challenging command, but it all starts right here. We've got to get this one right, folks. You know, the archaeological record tells us that there were idols. Idols have been dug up in Israel, all over the country. And it never ceases to amaze me how the skeptics, the critics of the Bible say, see, they weren't a monotheistic culture. They weren't worshiping one God only. They worshiped many gods. And I say, you knuckleheads, the Bible says they kept drifting. That's why you keep finding these idols in the sand. They broke God's very first command over and over and over again. It actually corroborates the biblical narrative. It doesn't refute it. That's another subject. The violation of the first commandment. And this is just one example of many, many, many we could give. But let's look at the revelation of this first commandment. What does it tell us about God? Remember we said last week, every commandment tells us something about the one who gave it. The rules you have for your children as a parent, that tells us something about you. What you want, what you hope, what you dream for your children. Same thing here. What does this commandment tell us about the God who gave it? See, that's what's timeless. Customs change, cultures change, and even covenants change, but God's character never changes. And so that's what I want to isolate for us today. Because that's what's timeless, that's what's always relevant, the very character of God. Well, I would say first, God wants and deserves to have primacy or preeminence in his people's lives. He wants it and he deserves it. He deserves it because he is the Most High God. There is none like him. There's none higher than him. He wants to be first because he deserves to be first. And he deserves to be first because he is God. And if he demands that he be first in our lives, it is for our benefit. If he really is tops, he doesn't need anything. He doesn't need us. And so if he tells us to put him first, it's for our benefit, not his. He doesn't need anything. Wrapped up in this command is the fact that God finds it revolting to have competition from substitutes. He finds it revolting. You know, whether it's hunks of wood or stone or metal in the form of idols, or idols of the heart, or the vain imaginations of people, the concoctions we spin out in our own minds, God's revolted by it. And if that rubs us the wrong way, folks, just listen. Think of it this way. Consider the fact that most spouses usually find it revolting to have competition from others. Husband, wife, and one goes astray, and the other goes astray. The other is wounded, the other is crushed. The betrayed one is revolted by that covenant disloyalty. And that revulsion is not rooted in something wrong in the spouse, it's rooted in the lack of the spouse's loyalty. As we said, some things were never meant to be shared. But here's the question, I think. Is God not humble? Is God arrogant? I'm first. I'm tops. I have to be there. I want to be there. I deserve to be there. Now sit down. I'm God and you're not. Is this God some sort of narcissistic God? Have you ever wondered? I mean, I can't say this. I'm first. He can. But if anybody else says it, we wonder, are they narcissistic? Are they self-centered? Are they not humble? Is there a character flaw here in the God who gives this command? It's clear that God is worthy to be praised, but why does he want to be praised? In fact, why does he demand to be praised? Deuteronomy 6:13 says he deserves it and he wants it and he necessitates it. Well, I would say that the first commandment allows no room for any other gods because Yahweh is the only true and living God. Now, that seems narrow and exclusivistic in our pluralistic age, doesn't it? Alternative substitutes, they're off limits, says God. And it raises the question of, is God ego heavy? Some people raise this question. Maybe you've never thought about it, but a lot of people have this. They don't like the Ten Commandments because they begin here. And they consider them suggestions anyway. They're not commandments. They're the Ten Suggestions. But is God insecure that he has to have top billing? You know, C.S. Lewis pondered this question. He was troubled by it because he thought about it. He himself thought about it. He put the question like this. Is God like a vain old woman seeking compliments? Sorry, ladies, that's just how he put the question. Is God like a vain old woman seeking compliments? And after soaking his head actually in the Psalms, he came to a very insightful conclusion. Let me read it for you. This is in his book, Reflection on the Psalms. He writes this. I think we delight to praise what we enjoy because the praise not merely expresses but completes the enjoyment. It is its appointed consummation. It's not out of compliment that lovers keep telling one another how beautiful they are. The delight is incomplete until it's expressed. Lewis goes on, it is frustrating to have discovered a new author and not be able to tell how good he is to someone else. To come suddenly at the turn of the road upon some mountain valley of unexpected grandeur, and then to have to keep silent because people with you care no more for it than a tin can in a ditch. To hear a good joke and to not have anyone to share it with. The Scottish Catechism, Lewis says that man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. But we, as believers, will then know that these two things are the same. To glorify God is to enjoy God. To enjoy God is to glorify God. And that's why John Piper went on to say, I think very rightly, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. But there it is. This is, in the end, for our benefit. To share with each other how wonderful God is. When I hear a good joke, I want to tell somebody. When I see something beautiful in nature, I want to share it with somebody. And the same here. God is giving us the gift of praising him alone because it fulfills a need we have because we're made in his image. That's what Lewis is getting at. And we deviate on this issue, folks. We've missed everything. It is like getting the wrong button in the top button in your shirt in the wrong hole. If I get the top button in the second hole, what happens to the rest of the shirt? I look like I do every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'm a slob, right? I double-checked this morning to make sure it was right. To be properly aligned by recognizing the supremacy and exclusivity of Yahweh and worshiping him alone brings about an internal transformation. This is what it's all about, being conformed to the image of God. There's great pleasure in worshiping God and God alone. Archbishop William Temple hinted at this transformation in his own definition of worship. Listen to this. He said, "Worship is the submission of all of our nature to God. It is the quickening of the conscience by his holiness, the nourishment of the mind with his truth, the purifying of the imagination by his beauty, the opening of the heart to his love, the surrender of the will to his purpose, all of this gathered up in adoration, the most selfless emotion of which our nature is capable." You want to be changed? Learn how to worship well. Worship the one true and living God. You know, the fact of the matter is, this God doesn't compel us to worship him. Now think about that for a moment. Think about this. God is utterly supreme in the universe, but he doesn't compel anyone to worship him. He could, and he doesn't. That's the very definition of humility, isn't it? This God is humble after all. He can compel worship, and he doesn't. He invites us to freely love him and worship him and put him first. That is the very in other words, the true living God of the universe, he allows himself to be rejected. He allows himself to be scoffed at, spurned at, walked away from. That's a humble God. And you know, like Father, like Son, because Jesus, when God was with us in human flesh, it's exactly what he did. And people walked away from him. They spit at him. They crucified him in the end. Like Father, like Son, to have all infinite power and still let the choice with knuckleheads who are going to blow it. That's humility. Like Father, like Son. Well, there's so much to say here. But I think you kind of get the heart of what God is saying to his people and for his people with this first button in the first whole commandment. It really is for our benefit. So I think by way of application, we can say this. Have you noticed God allows the existence of alternatives in life, but he wants us to choose the best. He allows these alternatives. There is a buffet table of gods and deities out there that you can worship. And many people put themselves on that table. I worship me. My church is my own mind, some people say. Well, hallelujah. I'm not worshiping your mind. But here it is. God allows the existence of alternatives, but he wants us to choose the best one. And he says, go for it. He's demonstrated he's worthy of our worship, but he leaves the choice with his people. He does not compel. Nothing else should be king in my life but God. That's really the bottom line here, isn't it? Nothing else should be king in my life. Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. Either you'll love the one and hate the other, or you're going to despise the one and love the other. Choose this day whom you will serve. Folks, what's number one in your life? Tolerance is a biblical value, but syncretism is not. Here's what I mean by that. Syncretism means we blend a little bit of this religion, a little bit of that religion, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we can just all get along, go along to get along. Oh, no. Tolerance. We don't go out picking fights with people who don't see things like we do theologically. We don't worship the God we worship. We can tolerate that, but syncretism, that stops at the door of the church. We don't have a little bit of Buddha, a little bit of Krishna, a little bit of Muhammad, and let's all stir together and have one big happy family. No, there's one true and living God. Now, as much as that rubs our pluralistic culture the wrong way, that's the way it is. And our God wants us to live in sync with reality. That's the key here. He wants us to live in sync with reality. And the reality is, he is God and we are not. God's people are to worship God alone. That's it. That's the message today. God's people are to worship God alone. Who or what is first in your life? Is it God?